We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're very happy to have you here with us listening. We're also happy to have here in the studio with us Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we have been doing for a long time now, once a month, to give you the chance to ask questions about home maintenance. So whatever's on your mind, you got a problem, something needs to be fixed, you're not quite sure how. You're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling. Maybe you're thinking about energy efficiency, any and all of that, all the various parts of the single-family home. We can take the questions, and Scott will see if he can help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We have a toll-free, so if it's long distance, use that. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, David. Always a pleasure to come out here and talk to folks and see if I can't help them out.
Anything in particular that's sort of on your mind that you might want to mention?
You know, the whole way in, I was thinking, what in the world can I come up with today? Because I know Dave's going to ask me this question.
Dave's always going to say, so, but, what do you want to talk about?
And you know, it's going to be basic and simple. Check the batteries in your smoke alarms and your carbon monoxide detectors. I've been doing a little bit of playing around with checking some of those, and I'm just absolutely flabbergasted at the number of them that are not functional. Now, most of the newer ones do have a low battery detector, so they chirp. Yeah. The idea is not to pull the battery out and to make it quiet. The idea is to replace the battery. I can't believe the number I find that have just no battery in them whatsoever.
Yeah.
Current recommendations are for a smoke alarm in each sleeping room and on each level of the home. So if you've got a basement, you should have one in the basement, preferably within about 10 to 15 feet of the stairway so it can be heard from both levels. But the smoke alarms and fire alarms should be on each level of the house and in any sleeping room. Now, on new construction, they're required to be hardwired so that if one alarm goes off, all of them go off. Mm-hmm. In existing homes, we can use the battery-operated units. Also a good idea to put in a carbon monoxide detector. It is required, state law. So you want to make sure you get that carbon monoxide detector. Now, you don't need one of those in each bedroom, but you do need one on each living level of the home.
Okay, and so, that was one, you know, when I got one, it's been quite a while, but I got one for our house, and when I looked at the instructions about where to put it, I got kind of confused because it said, for example, you don't want it to get, we have a gas stove, so you don't want it to get too close to your gas stove because there's a possibility it'll sniff a little something and it'll go off and when it doesn't really need to. So finding exactly the right place for it, I found really confusing.
I like to see them in the hallways near the sleeping rooms.
Okay.
That way, if there is a carbon monoxide source or a large quantity of carbon monoxide, they call it the silent killer. It does deprive your body of oxygen. And so if you have a high carbon monoxide level in the house, you basically get tired and go to sleep and don't wake up. So in the areas where you spend a lot of time, a hallway is good because you can hear it from a living room or you can hear it from a bedroom, something like that. It's a good idea to put one in a basement if you spend a time down in the basement. Yes, the furnace and water heater down there. If a flue pipe comes off, it may sound off upstairs, but the downstairs one will catch it first. Carbon monoxide probably is not a big issue in this area unless you really have something wrong. But it's a safety item, and it is a state law. I do know there are other areas. I know Champaign-Urbana, we've got a lot of forced air furnaces. And unless you've got a crack or hole in the heat exchanger, a blocked flue pipe, or a flue pipe that's been knocked off, chances are you're not getting much carbon monoxide back in the house. Also, if the product that you're using, whether it be the gas range or water heater or furnace, if it's burning with a good blue flame, it's probably putting off very little carbon monoxide. Mm-hmm. So usually only a system that is way out of tune, something that's got a really bright yellow flame, almost candle-like flame. You look at a candle, it puts off a little black smoke when you light it, things like that. That's putting off carbon monoxide. Mm-hmm. So as long as you keep your appliances pretty well tuned up, cleaned up, have your furnace checked once in a while, if you start seeing some black soot around the front of them, it's probably not a good thing. It means they're not getting enough air and they can be producing a lot of carbon monoxide.
Okay, so really, so the big sources of carbon monoxide in probably in most people's homes is going to be their furnace. If they have a gas furnace, going to be the furnace, going to be the water heater, also if it's heated with gas, and then the gas stove. But yeah, probably mostly it would be either the furnace or the water
heater.
Yeah,
because the range, obviously you're going to notice if the range is on and if it's burning yellow because all your pots and pans are going to turn black. But you can also get carbon monoxide from a car parked in the garage. Somebody forgets to turn it off, something like that. So there are a few other sources. If you do not have any gas-burning appliance, if you have an all-electric house, you're still required to have a carbon monoxide detector in the home if you have an attached garage. So even if you're thinking, hey, I haven't got any gas-burning appliances, I don't need one. If you've got a garage that is attached to the house, there's a door into the house, then yes, you are still required to have a carbon monoxide detector. In that particular case, I'd probably put it just inside the garage door rather than down in the bedrooms because it's all going to be coming from that area.
It's just going back to your thing about the smoke alarm, I'm sure that you're absolutely right. And despite the reminders that the fire department tries to do and generally as a safety minor to say to people, well, it's a good time to think about this, say, link that to the time when you change your clocks. So there, at least, you know, two times a year, that thing's going to happen. And then say, and then also put that on your calendar. Oh, yeah, okay, when we change the clocks, let's change the batteries. Or at least, you know, maybe once a year. Do it on New Year's Eve or something like that. Just so that you know that there's a particular time, at least once a year, you're going to do it.
Yeah, it's a good idea to walk through there and hit the button and see if it'll chirp. Yes, it's annoying. It's usually not a good idea while everybody else in the house is asleep. when you're out running around the house, like, hey, I wonder if that thing is working. I haven't checked that battery in a while.
Yeah.
So make sure they're in good condition.
Yeah. There's something else that just it comes to mind, and it's not really connected to what we're talking about. But it's I think also people are really you try to make the strong pitch to people that you ought to have an emergency plan for your house. That is, you ought to make sure you know how you can get out. And can you, for example, if there was a fire in the house and you had to somehow exit from the second story, could you do it? Things like, you ought to have a place arranged so that if there's some kind of emergency, everybody has to leave the house. There's some place outside where everybody's going to meet so you can make sure you have everybody and they're out of the house. Just a fairly small list of things like that people should think about and probably most people don't.
Yeah, it's something that doesn't come to mind on day-to-day stuff. But, yeah, it is a very good idea to have a couple of different plans for storms, where we want to go where there's no windows, where we can be safe from high winds. Not necessarily tornadoes. Yes, tornadoes, we want to get to a low level in the house. We want to get to a room with no windows and no glass, something like that. But we have, last weekend, we have some fairly severe winds that will come up very quickly. Where do you want to be? Well, in front of the picture window watching television is probably not it. So, yeah, a couple of plans. Okay, if there's a fire, where are all the escapes for the house? If there's high winds, where are the rooms where we should be congregating? You don't necessarily have to be afraid of the storm, just a little bit of precaution. Okay, let's not pick the room with the biggest window. Let's pick a smaller room to sit in while we have this storm. Things like that. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, our questions here are for home maintenance. We do it each month on the program, always on Monday. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So if you have questions about things like heating and cooling, doors and windows, siding, roofing, attics, basements, insulation, gutters, any and all of that, this is the time to call. And the number is 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Is this now a good time before we actually start running furnaces, if people are thinking about having an inspection, now would be a time to do it?
Well, I'm sure that the furnace guys aren't quite as overwhelmed as they were when we had the super hot days and they were all out running around fixing air conditioners. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a lull where they can probably get you a schedule to come in and do preventive maintenance.
Yeah. So what is it that they would be looking for?
on a furnace, they can come in and check and make sure that the heat exchanger is clean on the inside. We don't have any excess carbon, either soot buildup. Make sure that the flame is burning correctly. Make sure your flue pipe is attached correctly. We don't have some issues where the pipe is either coming loose or had some rust holes. Make sure everything is in proper, normal working condition. The fan isn't rattling and trying to shake itself right out of the box. Make sure that the filter rack hasn't fallen apart to where it's no longer filtering anything. And the air is bypassing the filter. Little things like that. So it's not a bad idea to. The newer furnaces are a little bit better about it, but still about every year or every other year to have a preventive maintenance done on the furnace air conditioning system.
Okay.
And the other thing, since we've got our weathered break and it's not quite so nasty to be outside, it's a good time to take a walk around the outside, particularly if you have wood windows. Look for any cracking putty or loose putty. The window glazing on your wood windows actually is part of the weather seal, because the glazing, the glass is in the frame, usually with a couple of metal pins, and then the glazing actually seals the glass to the frame. And over time, with sun and things like that, that glazing dries, cracks, falls out, and now you can get wind actually blowing around the glass in the frame. So rather than worrying about the frame and the weather stripping on the frame, you actually get the window to leak around the glass. So when it's nice out like this, you can get some glazing compound, go out there and clean those windows up and reglaze them, and save yourself a little bit of energy over the next winter.
Yeah. How, once you've done that, glazed the window, how long do you should you really expect that the stuff that's sort of like a little bit like clay, you know, you can work in your hands and get it soft and work it in that little area there in between where there's in between the frame and the pane. And then it gets essentially it gets hard and you can paint it. How long is that supposed to be good for?
It kind of depends on the window. If you've got an older home with some really old wood windows, the wood is dried out over the years, and you can actually suck some of or wick some of the oils that are in the glazing back into the wood, and so the glazing gets hard and cracks again. So if you've got some windows, say, pre-1930, chances are what you'll want to do when you're reglazing is to scrape and sand just a little bit, and then probably apply a light coating of linseed oil, which will then re-oil and seal the wood itself, the wood frame. And then when you put your new glazing compound in there, it doesn't wick all the moisture, or all the oils, all the liquid out of the glazing, so the glazing will last longer. Usually a good glazing job is good for 20, 25 years. Now, if you redo an old window that's really dried and cracked and checked, it may only last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a good tip that it actually, if the wood is really old and dry, because you want the glazing compound to maintain its
elasticity, a little bit of pliability.
It does have a sort of an oily feel to it. And if that, I guess if all that gets sucked out by the window because the wood is so dry, then that's it. It will be more brittle and tend more to crack rather than expand and contract with the.
And you'll also notice that most of the windows on your south side of your house are a little bit more affected than the north side because of the direct sunlight. So, yeah, like I say, on nice weather like this, we can still do some outdoor maintenance. I know on my house, a lot of things got deferred for the last couple of months because it's just been too warm to go out there and do things. And now that it's broken a little bit and we've got, 60 degrees in the evening and 80 during the day, it's prime time to go take a walk around the outside and say, okay, what can I do now that I'm not going to have to panic about later?
Yeah. Any besides that, looking at conditions of windows, anything else in particular you want to be taking a look at?
Well, I have my favorite, Dave, and that would be gutters and downspouts. In all the home inspections that I've done in Champaign County and the surrounding areas, water problems are our biggest issue. And if we don't address where the water's coming off the roof, where's it going? Okay, if I've got water coming down and I dump it within the first 2 feet of the foundation, where does it soak in? Does it soak in next to the foundation? Does it run out in the yard? A little bit of common sense. This is not rocket science. It's pure and simple gravity. Water runs downhill very easily. If downhill is back towards your house, then you can have water problems. And just about everything we run into, from excessive termite problems, mold, mildew, rot problems, wet basement problems, all these are usually attributed substantially, if not completely, due to improper guttering, downspouts, water collection, and water drainage around the outside of the house. I know it sounds super simple. I had one of my favorites over on Prospect Avenue. They called me up. We got a wet basement. I went over there, and there's about a 10-foot downspout extension that is getting the water out from behind a bush. It's disconnected. I reconnect it. The next rain, basement's dry. 4 years later, I get a phone call. Hey, we got water in our basement. I go over there. The downspout's disconnected. Reconnect the downspout. A new owner comes in about two more years later, calls up. Hey, we've got a wet basement over this house. And I'm like, okay, well, you're not going to believe this, but if you go out in front of the house, behind the bushes, and reconnect the downspout, the basement will dry out. Guy's gone his phone. He walks out there and said, how'd you know that was disconnected? So simple things can make a big difference.
Psychic. I'm psychic. I have an email here from someone that has to do with roof, who says, I have an older roof. Don't know exactly how old. The person here writes that they have three layers of shingles, which I didn't actually think you were supposed to do. But in any case, the person writes, well, short of a leak, how do you know when you need a new roof?
Well, shingles are made with either an asphalt or a fiberglass base that is then impregnated, saturated with asphalt. And the asphalt is protected from sunlight with a mineral granule coating, which is the coloring or the little rocks that you see coming out of your gutters when mm-hmm. you clean them. That is to protect that asphalt from deterioration from sunlight. When we start losing a lot of the granules and you can actually see the asphalt or the mat, the base of the shingle, then you're usually less than a year or two before you can need to replace them. And if they really start curling bad and have a lot of this missing granules and a lot of bare spots, you're probably looking at doing it sooner than later.
Yeah. Okay. And now about, so there also, she's going to definitely, looking at a tear-off,
yes.
All those other shingles are going to have to come off.
Three layers is not recommended. Most of the time, roof framing is not rated for the weight load. If you've ever picked up a bundle of shingles, they are not light. You start putting a couple layers of shingles on a roof, and it's amazing how quickly we can overload the roof framing. If she's got three layers and they are roughly 20 years a layer, we know the house is at least 1940s. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, back in that area, at least they used to use real 2x4s that were actually 2x4 after they were dried instead of 2x4 before they were dried. But they also used a 24-inch spacing and went a little bit longer on the spans, so we end up with a little bit more sag, so you end up with a bow in the roof. Never want to see three layers. Asphalt shingles is a first layer, which, by the way, is how the manufacturers warranty these things also. If you buy a 25 or 35-year shingle, it's based on them being the first layer. If they are a second layer over the top, that is not the same warranty. You do not get 35 years out of a set of shingles as a second layer. With more layers, we can hold heat. That heat tends to bake or cook the shingles. It wears them out faster. We're not getting enough ventilation through them. We're not getting as much air movement around them, so they tend to stay wet longer, and the moisture helps deteriorate them. So if you're going to buy 35-year shingles and you really want 35 years out of them, they have to be the first layer, and that's where your warranty will be, is for a first layer. I don't recommend the three layers because of the weight. I don't recommend the three layers as we start getting that many layers, they wear out much more quickly. Instead of, you can take your 25-year shingle, and it may last 15 or 16 as a third layer. 25 is a first layer, 20-ish, 18, 20 is a second layer, but as little as 15 years as a third layer just because of the amount of heat built up and collected, sort of like a cooking stone. You know, once the sun starts baking it, it stays hot for a long time.
Yeah.
It's just not a good idea. Also, it makes it harder to flash things because where we have roof connections to walls, chimneys, things like that, we've got to have a lot more flexible connection to these other surfaces, other perpendicular surfaces where water can get in. And with three layers, it's almost impossible to get them to flash correctly.
Okay, very good. Well, we have a caller here on the phone, someone in Georgetown, so we'll go there. This is line 4.
Good morning.
Hi.
I got a couple of questions, both of them related to my parents' home, built in the late 1890s, and I was given it. Two things. I had a new roof put on 2 years ago. I had had some leakage problems. Basically, I don't know when my grandparents added a porch to the home. I'm guessing in the 50s or something. It was an enclosed porch, but right where that was attached, the old T-shaped house is what's caused the problem, and that's where the leakage was occurring. So when they put the new roof on, there was some rotten boards. They put on new plywood, thought they got it, everything, but we've had leakage since. I mean, we repainted the ceiling where the water spots are, and now I've got a new renter moving in, and we've got some water spots again. He went up. Before we put the roof on, I had a man come over, and he thought he had it all taken care of. That was several years before the roof was put on, and then when he put the roof on, he could see the problem and supposedly took care of it. And now the new renter has noticed that there is still leakage, and it's right in the inset. We lowered this. My dad lowered the ceilings in the 70s, and so it's all that ceiling tile. And you can see it's like a little ridge right there where that porch was attached. It's like it's dropped or it's a little lower when they put the ceiling tile in. So that's where it's leaking. Have you got any suggestions on what they need to look for? Apparently, they aren't getting the right thing as to what the cause is.
Well, anytime we have an addition, it is a little bit trickier to make the connection and get a good water seal. Depending on where it is, you may need to have a section of rubber roofing put in a valley that then drops down onto your lower ceiling. What I run into a lot is when they do a porch addition, they put it right up underneath the soffit of the original roof, and they don't leave enough room for any true flashing. You really need about 3 to 4 inches for flashing to be able to go vertically upward to keep water from getting in behind. If we get a roof trying to tuck up underneath the soffit or something like that where we don't get that 2 to 3 inches vertical drop.
2 to 3 inches of what you said, vertical? Because they've changed the flashing. They've done that.
Okay. Well, the flashing needs to be able to be at least 2 to 3 inches high usually. They do make some bituminous tapes, basically a tar tape, sticky back stuff that you peel a paper off of and put on there, and the tar will then seal up any.
Because they've been up there and they've tarred it. they've tried everything.
Now, roofing tar is more of a temporary patch. Usually, particularly when you put a new roof on, we try and get everything sealed before we put the new shingles over the top of it.
Right.
And if you've got a real low-pitched area, then we need to look into rubber roofing or one of the one-piece roofing, roll roofing in a pinch. But
you're saying you mean you might have to take that roof off of that porch area, that addition. Rubber roofing on.
Well, what kind of pitch is it? Is it a pretty flat roof?
It's not a real high pitch.
Yeah, well, depending on what the pitch is, you may need to go with a rubber roofing rather than a standard shingle because you can get some debris on there. The flatter that shingle is, the more likely capillary attraction will draw water back up underneath the shingle and basically wick water back behind the shingles.
Okay.
So, without seeing it, obviously, and not knowing the pitch,
sure.
I don't know for sure. But
three different guys looking at it, three different people working on it, and we still haven't solved it, so that's why I thought, well, I'm going to call and see what you had to say.
Just out of curiosity, is by chance there a chimney in the slope somewhere near there?
There is a chimney. No, this chimney is not right there. Well, let's see. Yes, there is a chimney as kind of right next to it, right?
Yeah. It's amazing how you can get a water leak around something and it will wick into a completely different area before it comes out. I've seen water leaks 5, 10, 15 feet away from the original source.
Okay.
So if you've got a chimney somewhere near that that could be leaking into a valley, you might want to check the flashing around the chimney as well. But other than that, finding a fourth person to come out and look is about the only thing that I can come up with.
Well, I tell you, the high part, the top of the T has a, shale, is it shale? Slate. It's got a slate roof. And that maybe is going to have to be replaced. That has been on, I don't know if that's since the home was originally built or when they put that on. I've not changed that because a man came out and looked and he thought it still had a few years on it. But that's the top, that main top of the T, it has a slate roof. So whether, but that, and then the T comes out, and then on the side of the T is where this addition, you know, that the long part of the T coming out, that's where this addition, this porch was added, I'd say in the 50s or 40s or somewhere.
Okay.
I don't know that slate has, if it's, that's dripping off of that slate roof down onto that addition.
But the leak could be behind the slate and getting underneath the roofing on the addition. Slate roof, it's a stone roof. It was original to the house, I'm sure. It was not something that was added. The slate is sort of like the mineral granule we've got on the current shingles. It is the UV protectant for a membrane underneath. If the membrane underneath over the last 80 years is worn out and we get a couple of slates out of position, we could get some water in. So, yeah, it's very likely that you've got a leak somewhere in that slate roof, which is then getting underneath your newer roofing.
Okay. Well, that's what the possibility I was thinking. Then the other, I have my dad remodeled the whole home in the downstairs in the 70s and put newer windows in, and he put newer windows up in the upstairs also with the aluminum storm, which was a good line of window because, of course, it was built in the 1890s. So then he put new windows as of the 70. They moved in 73. But all the caulking, glazing, as you were just talking about, is all gone. It all needs to be redone. So my option is to put all replacement windows in that upstairs. There's 13 of them. Or to re-caulk and use those windows that are there. They do have the aluminum storm and screen on. The only heat to the upstairs is a register, you know, the central register in the hallway that the heat comes up from the furnace. It is a special pipe. It's not just coming from the living room downstairs. There's a special pipe from the furnace that comes up there. And when my parents remodeled in the 70s, they didn't use the upstairs except for a storage area, and occasionally when we went up there, my sons would sleep upstairs underneath an electric blanket. So there are two bathrooms are downstairs. There's just the three bedrooms upstairs and a long hallway. So is it worth the $4,000 that it's going to cost to put new replacement windows in, or should I just reglaze those windows? The family that's moving in, that's renting it, do want to use the upstairs, and they are concerned that the heat bill will be, because the two previous renters have not used the upstairs, mm-hmm. other than if they wanted to use one room, they put a little portable heater up there.
Right. Okay, well, I do believe that most wood windows are a very good investment. In other words, you don't necessarily need to replace them if they're in pretty good condition.
They were new in 74, whatever, okay. 73, 72 when he bought them. They were new wood windows then.
It kind of depends on the quality of the window at the time. But generally speaking, most wood windows can be reworked, and the aluminum storms fit tightly except at the bottom and be as or nearly as energy efficient as a new vinyl window. And vinyl windows eventually do deteriorate. As vinyl gets older, it gets more brittle. It can break. Vinyl does not have an infinite life. Wood, as a general rule, will last hundreds of years. Vinyl will actually deteriorate with sunlight. So,
how long can you expect a vinyl window to last, or do you know?
Depends where it's at. I know I've done some building out in Colorado, and you actually are not allowed to use vinyl siding or vinyl windows when you get up in the mountains because of the UV exposure, which is a lot more has a lot more effect up there in the mountains where we don't have as much filtering. Vinyl windows, I found them 30, 40 years old, but they're usually pretty brittle. Usually some of the lift springs are starting to break off. The latches aren't holding. So I would say that's probably about the extent of the life of a vinyl window. Whereas a wood window, you can rework a couple of times, get a good storm window on it. It sounds to me like your home has little or no insulation. It probably was not built with insulation.
It doesn't have insulation upstairs. They do. Yeah. My dad, because they took all the plaster and lath and everything down, and they got all the insulation on the downstairs, but there's nothing in the upstairs except that I put it up in the attic. I had them blow it up in the attic, and they have it in the attic. But we never did, cut the holes in the side and blow it in the sidewall.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some companies that do energy audits where they can come and find out where your energy loss is. Now, you've got a second story that has a single heat source. Anytime you have the heat source near the center of the room, or center of the floor, it's not going to radiate well to the outside walls. The outside walls, of course, are where the heat is radiating to, so they are the cold areas. So for comfort, you may need to put in some electric baseboards or put in a couple of different furnace duct runs to the outside walls.
I've talked to a heating contractor about how we could bring the heat up to each individual room, and we've talked about that. But the renters in the past haven't needed that, and so it's my choice whether I want to spend the money to do that or what. Yeah.
Now, you may first want to get an energy audit and find out where you're losing the heat, because it's always easier to save heat that you currently have than it is to try and add more. Yeah.
Well, I hope we've helped. I really need to jump in here. We have another caller, and I'd like to get some other folks involved. If there are folks who have questions, it's our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is here with us from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In hour two today, Robin Wright will be our guest. She is an award-winning journalist who spent a lot of time over the last several decades traveling in the Middle East and writing about it, and she has a new book that we'll talk about, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Some more talk about the politics of the Middle East and some of the political protests that we have seen going back to the beginning of the year. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour with Robert Malley. He's the program director for Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics. I always try to mix things up, so we hope there is something that will interest you. You can check the schedule or listen to past programs by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. This morning, and this part of Focus, we're doing our regular monthly show on home maintenance, and our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. If you have questions about your home, got some kind of problem, something needs to be fixed, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-800, let me try that again, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, Lafayette next, line one. Hello.
Hello. My question to you is whether it's time for a new furnace and air conditioning on a single family home that was built in 1950. The present appliances are both Carrier, the one with a SEER rating of 11. The other with its rating of 92. They were installed in 1997, 14 years ago.
I would say with the newer equipment that you've got right now, as long as they're in good operating condition and have been maintained, you should not need to replace them. The SEER rating on the air conditioner is the Seasonal Energy Efficiency Rating, SEER. Generally speaking, stuff that was made more than about 15 or 18 years ago probably has a SEER rating of somewhere between 6 and 8, whereas the newer stuff has 10, 11, 13. There's even some higher 15 and 16s available, although generally speaking, get quite cost prohibitive, almost enough that it's not necessarily worth going that. If I was going to put in new construction, yeah, I probably would, but to update an older home, you could probably better off spending the money sealing things up rather than going to a 16 SEER air conditioner. But since you are the house you're referring to with an 11 SEER, I think you're probably in the ballpark. As long as it's up and running, I don't know that it's going to save you enough to say, gosh, I should replace it. The furnace that you indicated is a 92% efficient furnace. Is a very high-end furnace. There is no reason why that should be replaced. There's a couple of furnaces out there that are higher efficiency, but not many. So therefore, again, you're not going to realize any energy savings by replacing one of that age. Now, in some older homes, you did indicate the home was 1940, 1950. Occasionally, I do find some that still have the original ones where we have an efficiency rating on the furnace of approximately 40 or 50%. Then, yes, by all means, we need to replace it. But with the new 92% that you've got in there and 11 SEER air conditioner, I'd say you're doing pretty good.
Could you guess at how many years more?
Most air conditioners are good for about 15 to 18 years. I've seen them last a lot longer. I've got one at home that's going a little bit longer than that, which I keep hoping it dies, so I have a good reason to replace it. But the furnaces, the newer furnaces I find go for about 25 to 30 years. The older ones that go a bit longer, but once you start getting much longer than that, they're probably going to have a newer model that's more efficient and a little better suited for the home, a little better for distributing the heat, things like that. So yeah, I would say 25 to 30 years is about all you're going to find on a furnace, and about 15 to 20 years on the air conditioner.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello. Is there a call there in Urbana, line 2? Well, okay, maybe they changed their mind. In any case, if you have questions for Scott Spies, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call, and we have about 15 minutes here, certainly plenty of time for other questions. If on a furnace, if you aren't really sure exactly how old it is, and you really don't know what the question is there some way to try to determine exactly what your efficiency level is on your furnace?
Well, most people have a fairly decent idea because at some point in time somebody came in to do a servicing or a cleaning, and most of the time they'll come in and try and sell you a new furnace if you have an older one. So they will say, hey, yeah, by the way, this furnace is getting up there in age. So most people do have a good idea. However, if you've just bought the home or you just never had it cleaned or something like that, it's not a bad idea to have a furnace man come out and give you an evaluation when he does his fall cleaning. A furnace will give you better performance if they are properly tuned, they have the flame adjusted correctly, if they're moving the proper amounts of air, we don't have any blockages, too much lint built up on the air conditioner coil, things like that. So it's not a bad idea to have them inspected every couple years. And at that point in time, your furnace man can give you a really good idea of about how old it is. Usually it's some hidden somewhere in the serial number, what year it was manufactured. Mm-hmm. But he can also give you an idea. I found a furnace the other day. I couldn't believe it. I took one look at it, and I'm like, this thing looks brand new. It's an 18-year-old furnace, and it looks brand new. I don't know if the young lady of the house went down there and waxed the outside of this thing or what, but this furnace looked brand new, 18 years old, and it was working perfectly. And she's like, well, I think it's time to replace that. And I'm like, well, I think you're taking very good care, exceptional care of this unit. I don't think you need to replace it yet. So,
all right, very good. Now, well, we're going to go to Hayworth for another caller, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Question on hairline cracks in basement floors. What do you recommend on maintenance of those?
Okay, kind of depends. In the basement floor itself?
Yes.
Okay. Generally speaking, the basement floor is not a structural portion of the house. It's merely helps as a vapor barrier and to keep your feet clean. So some small hairline cracks and fractures are fairly common. When you pour large slabs of concrete, it comes in wet off a truck, you pour it into the basement, it dries. When that water leaves, we lose a lot of mass, so therefore the concrete shrinks. Again, cracks are fairly common. As far as what you're wanting to do with it, they make some concrete fillers, liquid that you can pour in there. Very, very, very rarely will water actually come up out of a crack. If you've got water coming up out of a crack, we have what we call hydronic pressure, or water pushing up from underneath, in which case it's probably time to put a sump pump in, and the hydronic pressure will push the water to the sump pump and we can pump it away. If you're looking to keep bugs and stuff out of it, the pour-in crack fillers work just about as well as anything else, and then you can kind of level the floor out and put on whatever floor covering you're wanting to put down there. I don't know if you're trying to finish the basement or what. Is the crack creating a problem, or is it just an eyesore?
No, it's just an eyesore, and just, if you're going to finish the basement, that preparatory work to make sure you have things in place before you do that.
Yeah, generally the self-leveling fillers, which are, I'll call them a liquid, they're kind of thick, but they do flow to a certain extent, and so they kind of even out. They'll flow down into the crack and seal things up. They work about as well as anything else. They'd make a product called a floor stone, which is kind of a mortar mix that you can put down. It's a little more messy, but you can basically grind it or sand it down to give a smooth surface for underneath the carpeting or hardwood or whatever you want to put down there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. I think we're going to try again. Line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Caller there on line one. Well, I'm not sure what the problem is there with our... I think we have somebody who's trying to call us and they're not getting through. You can try again. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good any way that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We're taking questions on home maintenance. We have about 10, 12 minutes left, something we do each month on the program, always on a Monday, and our guest is Scott Spies, an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service.
Well, our last caller having the concrete question kind of brings up an issue that I'd like to touch on. It's amazing how many calls I get as an inspector for cracks in basement walls. Mm-hmm. Most of the new construction that we've had around here in the last 8 or 10 years has been with a poured concrete foundation. They put in a large form, a series of forms, and they fill it with concrete and let it dry. You will get cracks in that foundation wall. That's all. All I can say about it is it will show up. There is no way that you're not going to get cracks in there as things dry. Those cracks are not necessarily an indication of a structural failure, particularly if there's no significant movement. In other words, it hasn't gone vertically or tilted in or something like that. So I get people worried about water will come in. Water won't come in through the crack unless water gets to the outside of the wall. So we go back to my earlier analogy.
Gutters and downspouts.
There you go. I know it sounds like I touched on that way too much, but wow, does that ever play a big part in home maintenance, gutters and downspouts. So I get people calling, how do I seal up the cracks in my wall? And I say, well, go outside and keep the water away from it, and you won't have water come through it. But again, they do make some epoxies for wall cracks that were actually a structural epoxy that they can inject into the crack and seal them up. Most of the time, I don't feel that it needs to be done, but occasionally we'll get one that's moved enough where we have to put in this structural epoxy and actually glue the crack back together. For basement floors like our caller had, not a big issue because the floor itself is not a structural member. It's not a part of what's holding up the house.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm sure that though that they, if people do have water problems in their basements, that it seems like an attractive idea. They would say, well, isn't there something I could paint on the walls, something I could put on the walls and the floor inside to create that barrier so that the water won't come through? And I'm sure that if you have enough of a water problem and there's pressure, if any kind of thin coating that you put on the inside is just not going to it's not going to be enough to keep the water from coming in.
Usually a poured concrete basement, we don't have too much water coming through a wall because we have 8 or 10 inches thick of solid concrete, and it's very difficult for water to wick through. But when we have a concrete block basement, yes, we can get some water coming through. And, yeah, you can put on a coating on the inside, a couple different name brands that are available locally that you just roll on there, and they claim to seal it up. Well, okay, they will not seal cracks or gaps. So if you have any crack in a mortar or any gap anyplace, they're not going to seal that. Also, if you seal it from the inside, that means when the water comes in, instead of being able to come into your basement, it fills the hollow cores in the block with water. So the next thing you know, you have this hydronic wall all the way around your house. You have 4 feet of water standing inside your foundation. You're much better off going to the outside, finding out where the water's coming from and divert it away from the house rather than trying to seal it. It's like, you know, do you plug a hole in the boat with a piece of duct tape on the inside, or do we go to the outside and fix the hole properly?
All right. Let's go to an Urbana caller here, line one, right here. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Did anybody call in about a wood pellet?
Pardon?
A wood pellet for fuel.
No.
Oh, okay. What do you think of add-on wood pellet stove?
Okay, well, wood pellet stoves are an alternative heating device. Most of the time, they work well for small cabins, things like that. I'm not a real big fan of wood pellet stoves in areas where natural gas is readily available. If you're out in the rural areas where you're running on LP or something like that, they've got a lot more attractive ideas. The wood pellet stoves require a lot of maintenance, a lot of work. Wood pellet stove is not allowed to be connected into the same chimney or flue as any gas burning appliance.
Can you pipe in the hot air into the duct?
You can connect it to the ductwork, yes, but yes. You cannot connect the flue. So the wood pellet stove has to have its own flue system.
I see. Uh-huh. So and, Do you have some idea how much it would cost to add?
I have not. I had the opportunity to install one. You'd have to look hard at installation costs, plus the maintenance, and also how much time it's going to take you to fill the stove, clean the stove. So you end up spending a lot of your time at it. And if your time is worth as much money as most people, it's kind of hard to say, hey, this thing's really making me money. If you're in a rural area, or if you're in an area where we needed some alternative source, where, you know, say we're out in the middle of nowhere with an electric heat system and the power goes out on a regular basis, then yes, something like that is probably a good idea. If you've got a home that's all electric, a wood stove can be a practical solution to help bring in some additional heat without having to install a whole other furnace system, ductwork, what have you. But for the most part, the maintenance required on a pellet stove is a lot more than what most people want to put into it.
I see. Okay. Thank you so much.
It would be a big commitment to put one of those in there, because you've got to keep it stoked. You've got to keep it cleaned. Most people are more latchkey than that. You know, walk in the door, yep, okay, the house is the right temperature, okay, I'm leaving. To have to spend a lot of time at home and taking care of one. And there are some very specific maintenance issues that you have to keep done regularly, otherwise they can become a fire hazard.
Yeah,
so
that's if you have like in our house, we have a little wood stove, which is nice for recreational use, and it certainly puts out a lot of heat. But I don't think I would want that to be my only heat source for my house.
Now, for a mountain cabin, a getaway cabin, something like that, or if you happen to be out there in Homer on the river and want to be able to have a place you can go out to for a weekend or something like that, yeah, then in that particular case, I can make a very good case. They're very efficient. They create a lot of heat for what you put in them, but they are a lot more work.
All right. Very good. We have, again, about 5-6 minutes left, and now we have some of our other callers here. Urbana is our next person here, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for your inspector regarding his recommendation for radon testing and which systems he recommends, if there is a commercial one available for private use, and also what he feels about radon in our area.
Oh, that's opening up a can of worms. Radon, a colorless, odorless, invisible gas coming up out of the ground, basically a decomposing rock. If you're in an area that has a lot of rock, then we can end up with a radon, high radon reading. Radon itself is actually a very valid concern. You get out into Pennsylvania, the Redding Prong, you get up in the Dakotas, we can have radon readings of 200, 300, 400 parts per million, or parts per, what, picocuries. 100 million? I don't know what a picocurie is right off the top of my head. And those are very, very dangerous levels. The EPA has set their level of concern at 4 picocuries. They say that somewhere, if you have a level between 4 and 10, you should do something about it in the next 5 to 10 years. So they're not saying, ooh, 4 to 10 is immediate concern. They're saying, yeah, it's probably not a good idea. Now, a good statistician can pretty much make their numbers look their way, no matter what they put a slant on it and say, hey, this is what needs to be done because of this set of numbers. So the EPA says, hey, if we're over 4, if we're between 4 and 10, and you live in this house without opening a window or door for 350 days out of the year, and you live with all the windows and doors shut up and you don't go to work, then this 4 to 10 could be a problem. Well, yeah, I'm guessing it probably could, but I'm going to have to say there's probably another problem there if that's the case. If you're actually somebody that goes out, this radon is everywhere. It's outdoors. It's indoors. Generally speaking, if you have a tight house, we can start looking for radon issues. Here locally, the practice with the real estate market is to do a radon test that takes 2 to 3 days, and that test is accurate for those 2 to 3 days, but may be 100% off for the yearly average that the EPA bases their numbers on. So it's something to look into, but it's not something to necessarily panic about. I know in my Champaign-Urbana viewing area, for the most part, I find some levels right around that 4 picocuries, right around the borderline. The EPA has recommended that if you put in a 2 or 3 day test, and it comes up above their recommended level of 4, that you then put in a long-term test, being a 2 to 3 month test, to actually get a proper reading. The amount of radon coming into your house is varied by barometric pressure. If you're doing a test on a low barometric pressure day, stormy day, last weekend, it will be much higher than it would be on bright sunny days. So unless you've got a test that takes into account multiple weather conditions that we have here in central Illinois, you're not going to get a true reading of what the actual radon content is. Now, in most houses, eliminating the radon or reducing the radon level is not all that difficult. If you've got a crawl space, what they do is they put a good vapor barrier down, they seal it with tape, they put a pipe underneath the vapor barrier, and they take this pipe and they run it out someplace and put a fan on it, and they actually draw the air from the crawl space and blow it outside. For a poured foundation, it's a little more difficult. Usually they'll cover the sump pump hole and put a tube into that and run that tube up out to an attic area or an outside area and put a fan and, again, pull a negative pressure on the area underneath. So the repair or mitigation of radon is a matter of putting a low-pressure area or a sucking air out from underneath the foundation and blowing it to the outside to where the radon can dissipate. Is radon a problem? Yes, it is. I think I believe I did some research on this last year and found that the NCRP, which was the National Committee for Radon Prevention or Protection, and they set their level of concern at 10 picocuries instead of 4 like the EPA. So, I mean, there's some more research to be done on it. If I were to have a house and it were to come up at, say, 4.1, I'm not going to go panic and dig the house up, dig out underneath the house and start doing a lot of work.
Right.
But if you're in an area where you have a level that is 15 or higher, then, yeah, probably I would want to be doing something about it.
Well, then how would I test for this then?
There are companies here in town, including some of the home inspectors, that will do testing like that. But probably if it's your not purchasing the house, if you're already in the house, you can get a charcoal canisters kit. They're available online. I don't know of any of the stores in the area that have them, but it's basically a little canister that you take a piece of tape off of, you put it in the lowest level of your home, you let it sit there for 2 or 3 months, you then put the piece of tape back over the top of it, put it in an envelope, mail it off to a lab, and they send you a finding sheet, usually about $30 or $35. It's not a bad idea to do. It's particularly good for peace of mind.
Well, thank you very, very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, there, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have a caller we can't take. We're just out of time. Scott, we'll be back again next month. We'll do it again. Scott Spies is with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here every month. It's always on a Monday to talk about home maintenance. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, David. And thanks for everybody for calling in.